Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Right, hi everyone, thanks for waiting. And it's lovely to see so many of you at RSA House and online as well. And welcome to the Creative Freelancers Experience. So my name is Bernard Hay. I'm head of policy at the Creative Industries Policy and Evidence Centre, and we'll be chairing the panel discussion and an event today. So for those of you that haven't heard of the PEC before, we are led by Newcastle University with the Royal Society of the Arts and funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. And we thank them for their ongoing support of our work. So in June of this year, the UK government published its much anticipated Creative Industries Sector Plan, a new strategy to grow the creative industries as a priority sector in the UK economy over the next decade. And amongst the announcements made in that plan is one that's been campaigned for heavily by organisations across the sector, many of whom we'll hear from today on the panel discussion. And this is that by the end of the year, the government will appoint a new freelance champion to advocate for creative freelancers within government and with industry. So ahead of that appointment, today we want to explore what freelancing looks like in the creative industries, to understand how freelancers contribute to the economic growth of the sector, and to identify priorities for policymakers to support this vital part of the workforce. So to help us do that, we're delighted to also be launching our latest State of the Nation's report, Who Stays and Who Leaves in Arts, Culture, and Heritage Occupations, which, as many of you will know, is in part of the creative industries where freelancing is particularly prevalent. After this, we're going to open to an incredible panel of experts for a discussion, who I'll introduce later on, and then to audience Q&A. And just to say, we've got plenty of time for questions, and I know a lot have already been submitted ahead of the event, so we're really keen to give as much time as we can for your reflections and your questions. So before we dive in, just a few quick housekeeping notes. So for those of you that are in the room, there is no planned fire alarm. So basically, if you hear it, it's not a test, and just go to one of the nearest exits. The recording of this event will also be available after the event on YouTube, so do keep an eye out. And if you want to read the reports in full, it should be available now on the Creative PECS website. So at this point, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Mark Taylor, who's going to present some of the key findings from our latest State of the Nation's report. Mark is Research Lead for Arts, Culture, and Heritage at the Creative PEC and Senior Lecturer in Quantitative Methods at the University of Sheffield. So please join me in welcoming Mark Taylor.
Thanks, everyone. Good afternoon, as Bernard says. My name's Mark. I work at the Creative PEC, where I look after the research on arts, culture, and heritage, and I spend the rest of my time based at the University of Sheffield. I'm really excited to be here to give a promise, very brief overview of some of the research that we've been doing through the arts, culture, and heritage strand. The report that I'm going to talk to you about in a couple of minutes' time was not originally a report about freelancing. As you've heard from the title of the report, which I'll come to in a little more detail shortly, the project that we were working on was trying to understand the sort of career trajectory within arts, culture, and heritage occupations, thinking particularly about the sort of sustainability of careers. We've thought a lot about who is able to access these careers. We're also very interested in who's able to stay in them. But by way of background, in the analysis that we were doing, we started seeing that freelancing was a really important dynamic of some of the different kinds of decisions that people were making. Starting with just a little bit of background, in creative occupations, the broad category across the creative industries, the percentage of people who are self-employed is about double the equivalent figure for the overall workforce. Freelancing and being self-employed are not terms that are completely interchangeable, but in execution, by far the majority of people who are self-employed working in creative occupations are freelancers. And then even more people among what we might call arts, culture, and heritage occupations. This includes roles like actors and artists and people working in broadcast roles, things similar to those. Nearly two-thirds of those are freelancers. And there's a link to a report that was published on the PEC website, courtesy of Bernard and Roshi, who I think is in the room. There she is, where you can see some of these numbers in a bit more detail. And thinking about the sector plan, in order to develop a resilient, skilled, and diverse workforce, per the quotes, It's not just about recruiting people into these roles, it's also about retaining people. Because if people come in with really excellent skills and those skills are developed further, and then they can't maintain a career, this is a real problem for skill developments within these industries. And so this is a report, which is available as of today. As I mentioned, this is not a report that was originally designed to be about freelancers, but it has turned into a report where we have quite a lot to say about them. In terms of what we did, we really wanted to answer three main questions, which is, when people leave an arts, culture, or a heritage occupation, where do they go? Is it that people are moving to other jobs that they find satisfying and where conditions are reasonable and people are looked after well? Is it that they're leaving the workforce entirely? Is something else going on? Who are they? Is it the case that there are some groups of people who are particularly more or less likely to leave these occupations? And then what are the experiences? Or to put it another way, what's it like? If somebody leaves, what is the transition like? What are the things that are motivating that decision? And the way that we did it was a combination of a very large piece of analysis of quantitative data using the Labour Force survey. I will spare you the numbers, but we have rolled up about 10 years worth of different data so that we can both identify a large sample of people who used to work in arts, culture, and heritage occupations and now who they don't. A couple of different ways of measuring that, and then crucially allowing us to look at whether people who are leaving these occupations are different from people who leave other occupations. There's so much detail in the report, I'll spare you for the moment. And in addition to that, about 9 years ago, a team of us undertook a piece of research where we did in-depth qualitative interviews with 237 people who were working in creative jobs at the time. Earlier this year, we interviewed half of them again. So these are people who were working in creative jobs, and overwhelmingly these are people in arts, culture, and heritage jobs. Of those 120, 25 of them are no longer working in these occupations. So we're able to work with people who have left to understand what their experiences have been like. And this is kind of the key finding. Of people who were self-employed, or the majority of whom are freelancers, they are more likely to have stayed in an arts, culture, and heritage occupation than people who were working as employees. And that might sound like good news, and actually, it's a little bit more ambivalent than that. On the one hand, this doesn't show evidence that it's completely impossible to sustain a freelance career in arts, culture, and heritage. But one of the things that we also find is that people who are working as freelancers within one of these occupations are quite a bit less likely to move to another occupation, whereas people who are working as employees, that's a little bit more likely. And in order to try to unpack why this might be, we've worked with the interview data in order to try to identify some key themes. And this is a little cheesy, but I am now going to show you five P's. The first one is pay. And pay came up more than anything else. The freelancers that we were talking to, lots and lots of examples of the way that the income that they had as a freelancer was not really viable to sustain a long-term career. Lots of examples of people kind of making it work when they were younger, but not really be willing to stick with it long-term. For example, things like a transition into wanting to get a mortgage, not necessarily something that was attainable as a freelancer. This was something that was a major motivator for people leaving freelance work in arts, culture, and heritage, which is entangled with precariousness. Low pay is one thing, but low and unreliable pay is another thing, where what we found is that a lot of people were speaking to, and this included people whose incomes were actually, by comparison, relatively healthy, but the experience of not knowing where your next paycheck is going to come from, not being confident about how things are going to shake out, was another major motivator of, I should have clarified, every quote that I've shown you on these slides comes from somebody who used to be a freelancer in an arts, culture and heritage occupation. The precarity of, in some cases, being reliant on other people's income. But it's not just about labour conditions. One thing that came through very, very strongly from a lot of the interviews, particularly but not exclusively from women, was the incompatibility of parenting with their freelance career in an arts, culture and heritage occupation. I think this is captured really effectively by the first quote that we've got on the slide here, where somebody said to us that it was really hard for them to separate career planning from family planning. Their family planning decisions were very strongly entangled with their decision to leave arts, culture, and heritage. Another person also talked to us about when they returned from what was effectively a period of maternity leave, they found it much, much harder to be visible, partly as a consequence of the sort of hours associated with the kind of work under discussion. The pandemic also pushed a lot of people out. There was both a sense of a drying up of the amount of work that was available, where you know organisations, for lots of good reasons, were prioritising people who they had on stable contracts. But it's not, for a lot of the people we spoke to, that the pandemic fundamentally changed things. It's more that the pandemic crystallised some examples of existing working patterns, both in terms of the compounding precarity, but also a bit of a loss of a sense of fun, where there's a lot of things that are very positive and attractive about freelancing in arts, culture and heritage occupations. And when those things dissipate, the decision to stay in, I think, can become harder. And then the final thing that seemed to motivate a lot of people in terms of their departure was progression or its absence. We heard quite a lot of stories of people who said that they weren't able to charge any more than they had been 10 years previously. In terms of being able to progress to a more senior role, there was a story from somebody that I haven't included here where they were saying, you know, they were effectively waiting for somebody else to leave, that people's opportunities for progression felt like they were outside of their hands. But it's not all bad news. When we were talking to people about their experience of leaving arts, culture and heritage freelance occupations, they had quite positive things to say about how they were able to use their skills that they developed in their creative lives in other sectors. We heard stories about how people felt they weren't necessarily very confident when they decided to take the leap, but actually there was a great acknowledgement of the value of the skills that they had been able to demonstrate and articulate in their creative jobs. Lots of stories about the value of being able to successfully write a bid. And so there is some positive news. It's not just a case that lots and lots of people working in arts, culture and heritage freelance careers were very, very unhappy. Actually, while a large number of people did end up leaving, while there's a certain amount of ambivalence and sadness about no longer working in this line of work, there's also a lot of happiness about the kinds of transitions that they have made. And so I would make two key points in terms of the takeaways from the reports. The first is that self-employed people working in these occupations are actually a little bit less likely to leave than their employed peers. But for those people who do leave, it's a little bit more difficult based on the numbers that we have to transition into another occupation. The five P's that I mentioned raise some concerns and questions about how viable a freelance career might be in the longer term for people. But at the same time, we did see lots of examples where people have been able to use their skills in other sectors. I promised I would do my best to keep it brief. I don't want to talk for too long. I think those are some of the main headlines that I wanted to draw out. As I mentioned, there's lots of material in the report. I'd be very happy to chat to anybody who might have any follow-up questions. Some of my co-authors are here as well. I'm sure they would be as well. But ultimately, I think a lot of the value in this session is to hear from people working in the sector and freelancers themselves. So I'll wrap it up there and let's go into the panel. Thanks very much.
Let's grab a chair. Okay, so thanks so much, Mark. So I think at this point, we're going to invite our panelists onto the stage, and we'll do quick introductions. So here we go. Okay. So yeah, I think I think Mark's five P's will probably resonate quite a lot with what we're going to explore in the panel. It'd be really interesting to hear maybe how some of those experiences also vary across different parts of the creative industries and different parts of the freelance workforce. But I'm really delighted to introduce an incredible panel of experts to help us unpick and explore some of these issues in a bit more depth. So we have with us Alex Jacob, who's a freelance television director and member of Directors UK, who's had a career spanning over 25 years in film and television, from runner to director of Emmerdale and Coronation Street, which is
a little pretty more than that, but yes.
Amazing. Pretty remarkable journey. Next to Alex is Philippa Childs, who's Deputy General Secretary at BEC2, which is a union representing over 40,000 creative industries members. And Philippa's been done a huge amount of work sort of championing and advocating for freelancers in the sector, so really excited to hear your reflections. We then also have Amy Tarr, who's Associate Director of Policy and Research at Creative UK, overseeing their national policy work, and also recently co-authored a number of reports on freelancing. And then last but by no means least, Yasmin Khan, who is Director of Individual Practitioners and London Arts Council England. So balancing both representing freelancers within Arts Council, but also overseeing around 60 national portfolio organisations in London. So incredible remit. So Alex, I'd love to start off with you to get your reflections on, you know, what is the creative freelancers experience, and if there's anything that's maybe come out from Mark's research that you'd like to draw out on a bit more.
So, I should clarify that in terms of freelancers, I very specifically work in film and television, have done for over 30 years now. As Bernard said, I started as a runner, been directing for the last 15, 16 years. I've made loads of notes, so I'm going to refer to my notebook as we go. The first thing I really want to say and clarify is that I have genuine gratitude for the fact that I have had been able to sustain a career. I know that I'm privileged and be able to do what I do, be a storyteller. And I don't think there's anybody really who works, and certainly in film and TV, who doesn't have that gratitude being able to do what they do. So there are loads and loads of upsides. Obviously, we're here to talk about the challenges, so I'm now going to moan for the next 5 minutes. The biggest thing really is financial precarity. It's not just that you don't know when your next paycheck's coming. I finished my last job in May. They do still owe me a little bit of money for when the episodes get delivered, but I'm not going to have another paycheck until March. So I have to go long periods without an income. I'm very fortunate that I do come from a background where I had an inheritance when my parents died. So I know that, again, I have a privilege with that. And I also have a wife who has a real job. So, we do get by. But I know it's not the same for everybody. I know people who really, really struggle paycheck to paycheck. And it's not just the income. It's the matter of having to deal with the financial institutions when you want to get a mortgage. It's not just 3 months of pay slips. It's 3 to 7 years of income that you have to show. And especially if you're moving through your career, those years can be really, really different. Even when you're just clicking one of those, you know, when you're getting your car insurance and you're trying to click down, what's my job? It's just not listed. And if you do say you work in TV or film, they won't insure you. I actually have my own limited company. It's a service company, but that's enabled me to say I'm a company director, so I can get car insurance at the same rate that the rest of the country pay, and not at the heightened rates that people in film and TV have to pay. Childcare, the cost of childcare. I actually took 3 years out of my career when my wife moved to a different role, because we worked out that for what I was earning, it didn't cover the childcare costs. So I just didn't work for 3 years. And actually, I mean, it was the best 3 years of my life, don't get me wrong. I love spending time with my kids, but I did miss out on various career opportunities on some really big shows that I could have worked on. And then in terms of the actual nitty-gritty of being a freelancer, there's things that, and this is something that that gets my goat, is there's the Action for Freelancers organization, which is a collective by industry, by freelancers, It annoys me that we need that. It annoys me that the industry, like the people from industry that are getting involved in that, because if they really cared, we wouldn't need it. And it's things like travel and expenses. I used to live in London and travel all over the country. And when I lived in London, I would more often than not get my travel and expenses covered. Now that I live in the regions or in the nations, if I've got a job in London, they won't pay. I don't take jobs in London because I can't afford to pay for the accommodation. I worked on a job last summer, year before, and we had a runner, the lowest paid member of the team, who came down from Glasgow to work in the Northeast. She was paying her rent at home in Glasgow and having to pay rent in the Northeast of England as well, because there is no support for the lowest paid. I know people, senior members of production teams, like the DOP, there's one DOP I know who has a camper van. So when he drives down from Newcastle to work on, say, Casualty in Cardiff, he sleeps in a camper van for 2 months, 2.5 months. And there are loads of crew members that do that. I thought about doing that as well, but it was when I became a director, more often than not, they actually accommodate you, unless you're going to go and work for various companies in London. That actually is a whole other thing about discrimination against those who live in the nations and regions. When I was on the board of directors at Direct UK, I was the nations and regions rep. There's a whole thing, the whole traitors issue, the BBC traitors show, that's a whole issue of what qualifies as regional programming. I could bang on about that for hours, but I'm not going to. The length of the working day, especially in film and TV, especially in drama, we work 11-hour days as standard because we always have. It doesn't need to be like that, but it always is. But the thing is, that's the filming day. Every single department, just about, comes in an hour before, goes home an hour later, invariably doesn't get paid. You throw into that the issue of late scripts, which is more than common on almost any show that I've ever done. And almost every department member is working all those additional hours. I did a show a year and a half ago where the scripts were so late that I was putting in 16, 17, 18 hour days every day and doing 10, 12 hours at the weekends just to deal with the changing scripts, just to deal with the fact that somebody somewhere up the food chain wasn't organized enough to commission the scripts in time before production started. And that's a failure of leadership at the very top. And I know there's lots of reasons, budgetary reasons, the way the annual budget is formed, so you can't invest the money in the development. But the bottom line is, it means the people on production are subsidizing the inefficiencies of those at the top. Bugbear of mine, sorry. Mandatory training that you have to do. This is another tiny little thing. So many companies, especially ITV and BBC, I'm going to say them out loud, require you as a freelance to do mandatory training before you start your contract. And so the mandatory training takes about half a day, but you've got to do it in your own time. How many staff members who work for those companies are asked to do that same training on the weekend when they go home? I bet you none of them. The issue with being freelance really is that because of what you do, your reputation is your CV, it's your calling card. So that means you do put yourself into a position where you will turn up for work regardless. I've driven to work with a sick bowl on my lap, vomiting on my way to work because I didn't want to let them down, because I didn't want to get the reputation as being the person that didn't turn up on day one. When my father passed away, I was on a job. I lost a week's wages because I wasn't at work for a week. I phoned up and said, my dad's not going to make it. I need a week. And they're like, okay, great. They replaced me. They didn't pay me. I got COVID on a job recently, well, a couple of years ago now, but it was after quarantine was no longer required. Company policy was if you have COVID, you quarantined. I didn't get paid. Again, if I'd been a staff member, I would have got paid. I know somebody who I spoke to this afternoon, and she's okay with me saying this, is that 3 days after her husband died, she was back at work because she was the sole breadwinner for her three children. 3 days, because there is no bereavement pay, there is no compassionate leave. If you're freelance, if you don't turn up, you don't get paid. Yeah, go on. I said I was going to waffle on. I said I could keep talking. Yeah,
not at all.
I've got lots more pages. I just want to kind of wrap it up really quickly with them. One of the things that is really important to my mind is the importance of copyright and royalties and residuals. It's why things like Directed UK and equity are so important, because being able to have those core creators, the musicians, the writers, the actors, the directors, get the benefit of the work that they create, it enables them to then develop and develop more projects, which leads to more work, which leads to a return for investment. So the protection of copyright for creatives, I think, is one of the things that's essential to maintaining our creative industry.
No, it's so helpful, Alex, and I think a huge amount to reflect on there. But I think also as well, I mean, really highlights, I think, the importance of membership bodies, unions, who are often doing a lot of this work, supporting and upholding those rights for their members. So, Philippa, I'd love to hand over to you to get your reflections.
Thanks. And as ever, very sobering. And I think Alex has sort of shared lots of reflections that lots of Bechtu members would share, indeed. So Bechtu is a trade union, as Bernard said, and we represent creative industries workers who are pretty much non-performers, although we do have some film artists who are also our members. And we operate across film and TV, but also theatre and live events. So we have a wide range of membership. What's interesting, I think, about our membership over the years that I've been in the role that I'm in, is that it's really changed from being very much employee-focused to the balance has really tipped towards having more freelancers amongst our membership. And I think that was something that happened gradually, but sort of accelerated through the pandemic because of all the challenges that freelancers faced through the pandemic, particularly falling through the gaps of the various government support schemes. So not only did work dry up, but also so many people didn't have any financial support during that period. What's been really interesting is that I think during that period, but then subsequently, freelancers have recognised that they want to have a collective voice and that they do want to campaign around the types of issues that Alex has highlighted and have been highlighted in this report. So we have been campaigning quite a lot, and actually quite a lot of our focus has been going into the freelance question. Hopefully we're still doing the daily work for members who are employees, but definitely there has become more of a need to do this campaigning work on behalf of freelancers. And you know, whilst the government have done great things for employees through Make Work Pay and the Employment Rights Bill, we think that there is a piece of work that they can now do and hopefully will do to support the freelance workforce better. We did a similar survey. We didn't manage to come up with 5 P's. Drat it. But earlier this year, we did a similar survey of our members. We had about 5,500 responses. And again, there was very strong messages coming from that piece of research around the freelance workforce in particular. And what concerned us, I suppose, is that a lot of people were out of work at the point that we surveyed them. So something like 30% were out of work at that period. That rose to something like 43% for those working in film and TV. And, you know, film and TV in particular has had various shocks since the pandemic. So obviously the US strikes caused a lot of film production to stop in the UK as well. People who were just beginning to recover following the pandemic then had another long period out of work. And then obviously the challenges for broadcasters has brought more pain for freelancers working in film and TV in particular. I think there are different challenges for our freelance members in theatre. And again, different again in live events, where there is lots of work in live events at the moment, but it pretty much is the Wild West out there, and people don't even get written terms and conditions and all of those sorts of things. So there is lots of work to do in terms of campaigning on behalf of freelancers. And so yes, we've been very vocal about the need for a freelance champion through the government's discussions around the industrial strategy, because I really do think, I am hopeful, that having someone at the centre of government who is particularly focused on the creative industries, who really is able to get under the skin of all of the challenges that we face in the industry. So Alex has mentioned some of them, but there's also the issue of late payments, which is a pretty classic problem across the industry. There's also, our research shows that bullying and harassment continues to be a huge problem. So we've been very welcoming of the Creative Industries Independent Standards Authority, which is being developed as we speak. I know that you mentioned Action for Freelancers, and yes, you're right. Mm. It should come naturally, but I also welcome the fact that the broadcasters were prepared to sit down with us and freelancers more generally and talk about the challenges that freelancers face, and are committed, I think, to different degrees to try and address some of those challenges. And certainly the BBC has been pretty instrumental in that, in terms of having those conversations. So I think there is a growing recognition that the freelance workforce needs to be supported better. I'm very optimistic about the freelance champion, although it is a huge task for somebody whoever takes up that role, and lots of challenges to deal with. But I think we're all sort of committed to working with that person and hopefully getting them to understand very quickly the industry and the sort of challenges across the industry, which can be different in different areas. So I'll leave it there if that's okay.
Thanks, Philippa. No, and I think, to pick up on a key point that you made, the challenges for freelancers look different across different parts of the sector. And I mean, Amy, I guess as Creative UK, you're representing a whole spectrum of different creative subsectors. So we'd love to hear a little bit more about your reflections on some of this and what you found in some of your recent research in this area too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think as a starting point, hearing from Philippa from the research earlier and particularly from Alex, we end up being a panel, actually, that will come together with significantly more consensus than there is divergence, because across all of the research and through the lived experience that we're hearing, it's that precarity that is absolutely endemic within this model. Now, if you put that in the context of what is a sector that contributes $125 billion to the UK economy, it's a thriving sector. It's been recognised as such in the fact that it is part of the government's modern industrial strategy. So we sit as one of 8 priority growth sectors alongside advanced manufacturing, clean energy, financial services, defence. And yet, if you look across the piece with those sectors, self-employment sits at around 10-12%. Within our sector, it's double, 3 times that. And in some subsectors, if you look at film and TV, live events, parts of design, that goes up to kind of 50-70%. I think if we were looking at 50-70% of financial services or advanced manufacturing operating under this precarious model, it would be seen as a kind of productivity emergency. The reality is, for the creative industries, this is the operating model. This is what allows productions to come together at pace. It's what allows innovation to move from project to project. And it's what allows that kind of skills transfer to happen in a way that we really need for the kind of innovation, the creativity that we all thrive on. The issue is that policy and the structures that sit around that model haven't caught up. So, you know, what this research is surfacing, what all of our research has surfaced, that there are all of these issues that need to be addressed. We need to address late payment, we need to address unfair working conditions, we need to make sure that there is access to skills and training and CPD. And that's, you know, that's important. So in terms of at school level, how are we preparing people to come into a sector that has in some parts a predominantly freelance self-employed model? You know, we don't have careers service that offers support to develop, that even offers really an understanding of what it is to be go as your first step into the career, into the kind of world of work as self-employment. What are we seeing within the FE&HE space to make sure that business acumen is absolutely embedded within those courses? And from a CPD perspective, we heard from freelancers that it was the single biggest issue that they think is preventing career progression once they start that freelancer journey. So all of these things need to be addressed. I think one of the things that came out of the research that we've heard about today is in terms of that kind of the likelihood of exit, those that have caring responsibilities are more likely to exit the workforce than those that don't. Well, certainly from a kind of childcare perspective, that, as Alex has said, that's an enormous issue. But you know, we're shoring up other issues here. We have a reducing working age population, growing caring responsibilities because we have increasing life expectancy. How are you expected to operate within a model that is predominantly freelance when you then subsequently have long-term care responsibilities? How are you supposed to save for your own retirement in that sort of environment? So I think, you know, this all sounds very doom and gloom, but I agree very much with Philippa that it is a really positive step to see within the creative industries sector plan a recognition that one of the ways in which we will achieve those kind of growth opportunities is if we address this precarity and we have a role that sits centrally and is able to look across the piece and start to unpick the issues at an individual level and develop a very coherent approach to championing the realities of freelancers across the government.
Great, thank you, Amy. And I'd really love to kind of come back and maybe unpick some of those points around sort of social security and how you provide that support network. But I think that segues really nicely as well to you, Yasmin. I guess, you know, Arts Council England is playing such a big role in supporting, you know, cultural workers, cultural practitioners across the country. Tell us a little bit more about the work that you're doing at Arts Council and some of the issues that you're seeing in the work you're doing as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bernard. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you to the Creative PEC team for the invitation. And thanks, Mark, for that great, compelling presentation. Now, I just wanted to share a reflection as you were talking, because you framed the report, who stays, who leaves. But something in my mind is who's also coming in. And there just frankly isn't room for everyone. So there needs to be that movement. I think what we need to create are pathways to work opportunities, and that's the underlying issue. So I started my new role last September as Director of Individual Practitioners, and in my previous life I freelanced for over 10 years as an independent curator and cultural consultant, so I fully understand what it's like to live life on the edge. My remit is to work with colleagues to embed a freelancer focus in everything we do across Arts Council. And I work closely with Erica Campaign, our senior manager for individuals, and she's with us on the live stream and will be joining in the online chat. So I'm going to talk about the work Arts Council is doing to support individuals and how we're using the insights from our freelancer study to identify possible interventions and shape our decision making. But just for some context, for those that may not know, Arts Council England is a national development agency for creativity and culture. We have a number of funding programmes, Developing Your Creative Practice, DYCP, which is dedicated to individuals, and our National Lottery Project Grants Programme, which provides funding to both organisations and freelancers to deliver projects that have a public benefit. We've just launched a new R&D fund for individuals, and that's open for application on a rolling basis. So just to give an idea of how much investment per year, last year we gave Developing Your Creative Practice grantees 14 million and project grants 28 million directly to individuals. So as part of Arts Council commitments to increasing support for creative practitioners, my colleagues commissioned researchers from the University of Essex in 2023. So this is before my time, and ironically, I was freelancing at the time and I myself filled out this survey. Mm-hmm. So they commissioned researchers from the University of Essex to document the current challenges and opportunities experienced by creative and cultural practitioners in England. And the aims were to provide us with comparable data on the freelancers we fund from the different range of art forms across the cultural sector. So namely that's combined arts, theatre, dance, music, museums, visual arts, literature and libraries. And since then we've just introduced a new classifier for digital arts. So we needed this baseline research that, so that we could evidence a contribution that freelancers are making in the sector to better advocate for their needs and work out what would be the most effective interventions to help create a more equitable future for freelancers. So the study consisted of a literature review, focus groups, and an online survey of over 5,000 responses from across the regions, and the demographic of respondents were representative across age, gender diversity, and career stages. And in terms of what we heard, our freelancer study showed that in reality, most freelancers have a hybrid portfolio and do a combination of different types of work to make a living. So from our respondents, 7 out of 10 of them mainly work as a freelancer, and the rest combine freelance work with salaried work. The survey also showed the varied types, frequencies and combinations of freelancer roles. So more than half identified with having a creative role, such as being an artist. The other categories included participation and engagement, managerial, admin, technical and front of house roles. And interestingly, more than one-fifth of respondents work as freelance educators. And this is a fast-growing segment, the rise of the independent researcher. So there's something about the university dynamic and the lack of permanent jobs in universities that is increasing the flow into the freelance workforce. So I just wanted to share some key insights. I'm not going to go into detail because I've heard from my colleagues already, but just to underscore, 73% of respondents earn less than 25k a year from their freelance work. So that's obviously less than the national living wage. There's an endemic issue of stagnant pay, lack of pay progression, lack of access to mentoring, coaching, and affordable career professional development. 60% of freelancers who took part in the study reported they are not members of a union, and the reasons range from unable to be affording the cost of that or not trusting that they could be effective in advocating for their needs. 68% of freelancers surveyed were unable to contribute to a work-related pension or to make financial provision for their retirement, so that is a huge ticking time bomb. 91% of survey respondents reported having a higher education qualification, suggesting a highly qualified workforce of predominantly graduates who are lower paid than other peers in different fields. And as Alex mentioned, being paid late, not being refunded for travel costs, and not being paid for sick leave came up again and again. There were issues of attrition, that freelancers hitting an income wall mid-career, forcing freelancers with valuable skills and experience to leave the industry in search of better income security. And on the note of equality and diversity, nearly half of respondents feel the cultural sector is not very inclusive at all and report experiences of discrimination, harassment and stereotyping. There's also widespread concern about social class and cultural elitism and a stigma faced by disabled freelance professionals. There was also a big section on mental health and well-being and the demoralising effects of a lack of work-life balance, the fatigue, anxiety caused by insecurity and the unpredictability of work in the sector, which led to the burnout and poverty cycle, where high levels of anxiety around job insecurity, shaped by the fear of running out of work, creates a situation where many take on all or any work that is offered to them in order to manage financially. And then they find themselves struggling to cope with that workload. So there was a final section that talked about the wider context, and those challenges included the reduced impact of state funding, sorry, the impact of reduced state funding on grassroots art venues in particular, the effect of COVID pandemic, the stifling effect of Brexit on migration policy and visas for international artists, and the cost of living, particularly on those with parenting and caring responsibilities. And then last but not least, this was a rising issue at the time, but it's obviously blowing up now, AI and protecting copyright was a big fear. So in essence, that's a perfect storm of unfavourable conditions, which needs a holistic and systemic approach to tackle. And there is no single magic bullet solution to this.
So in terms of next steps, now we have this valuable baseline data set and we hope to repeat that study in 3 years so we have this longitudinal data. We're developing a theory of change to begin to activate some interventions, and I've written a blog on this and it's got a visual with a problem tree, so I won't go into too much detail now. But basically, in order for freelancing to be less precarious, we've got to get to the underlying root causes rather than just dealing with a surface level effect such as burnout and attrition. Basically, that the symptoms of market failure cannot be resolved without creating more opportunities and identifying what fundamental national policy changes would make the biggest difference beyond a lack of funding. So Arts Council can't fix a broken gig economy, but what we can do is work with other sector agencies to advocate for change. And one of our research conclusions is that the sector lacks a single destination resource of good practice. Whilst we have already produced a range of online information sheets, we do need to increase awareness and engagement and buy-in. So we want to streamline and repackage our policies, update them, and make them more accessible into a single handbook for freelancers that will be a useful resource for the wider sector also. And in the spirit of nothing about us without us, we set up a pilot freelance advisory circle to help us co-produce this handbook, which we hope will be a universally useful resource. And we hope to launch that in the spring. We've also been mapping the ecosystem of freelancer support schemes in the sector, and we'll be building on these insights to develop what we're calling an opportunities atlas as a companion to the handbook. And then I just wanted to note that this ties in really neatly with the remit of the incoming freelancer champion, because in their terms of reference, there is a line that talks about supporting the creation of a single freelancer hub to host key resources and guidance alongside information to get different types of support. But of course, their remit is across the creative industries and across the UK, whereas we're focused on England and particularly in the cultural sector. But there is a nice synergy. I could give loads more examples, but I will stop there.
No, that's brilliant, Yasmin, and I think really encapsulates the kind of breadth of issues that are going to be on a freelance champion's plate when they come in, right? So there's a lot there to unpack, and we've had a lot of questions already coming in from the audience online. I'm really keen to open it up to questions from those in the room as well, but before we do, I just was keen to maybe focus on just a couple issues that have been kind of common threads through from all the respondents, and really to start to think about, you know, what are some of the kind of policy opportunities or changes that might be made to kind of address some of these? And, you know, I think the one that really jumps out for me, particularly in a context where we still have a cost of living crisis, was the points made consistently around pay, and particularly as well the impact that has on freelancers' disposable income. And Philippa, I know that Becky's been doing a lot of thinking about this, both around industry practices, but also supporting research to look at other kinds of government intervention that have happened across the world, other parts of the country that might be adopted here. So could you tell us a little bit more? I mean, what do you think are some of the opportunities that could be developed to address this?
Yeah, so we've been, I started talking about this during the film and TV crisis, because obviously there were huge numbers of people who were out of work and having to rely on the film and TV charity to pay their bills, or, you know, just keep them going through a crisis, and lots of people were planning or actually leaving the industry. So we started to look at what happens across the globe, I suppose, in terms of how other governments use tax and benefit systems to better support the freelance workforce. And I suppose the best known one is in France, where they have this intermittence support for the creative industries. But there are also lots of other examples, actually, and together with the Film and TV Charity and the British Screen Forum and other organisations in film and TV, a piece of research was undertaken to look at what would happen if you took some of those systems and put them into the UK. How would they support the creative workforce and freelancers in particular? I'm not sure. I think the jury's still out, actually, in terms of, you know, is there one system, is there one intervention that would make a difference? But because I suspect, because of the different challenges in different parts of the sector, so yeah, it's very much low pay, I think, in the arts, whereas I think for film and TV, it is that intermittent work challenge that is really problematic for people, because they aren't, you know, so some of our members are paid, you know, pretty well when they're in work, but if you're only in work being paid pretty well for 3 months out of 12, then you're not going to be very well off. So I think the next piece of work actually that we're all going to hopefully be involved in is looking at what interventions we can make, and hopefully again that's a task for the Freelance Champion. We can start to talk to them about how do we use the systems that we've got to make sure they work, because they don't work, let's be clear, they don't work at the moment for freelancers who can be in and out of work on a regular basis. How can we put in place interventions that mean that, you know, all of those skills and talents that inevitably our members have, that we can keep them in the industry, and that they can actually not only survive but thrive in the industry. And I think that's, for me, that's sort of number one on the agenda in terms of what we want to try and fix.
Definitely. And, you know, I think, Amy, if I could turn to you, I mean, I think this also really speaks to some of the issues that you highlighted, particularly around things like pensions.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's really scary when you see some of the statistics from some of the surveys that have been shared, the small proportion of freelancers that feel able to contribute into a pension because of those pay issues. And I know that you've been doing a little bit of thinking about, you know, innovations around pensions that could help to support this. So could you say a little bit more about some of the thinking that Creative UK is doing in this area?
Yeah, I mean, it's really early days with us, but I think one of the things that has come out of not just our research, and it was really pronounced within the Arts Council England piece, is that, you know, if you're looking at a cohort that is facing retirement like we all are, where 60% of those people or more have no retirement savings whatsoever, you know, you are ending up with a precarious working life situation that is just subsequently compounded when you reach retirement age. That has been an issue more broadly across the economy, and there was the kind of the answer that was given to that kind of 15 years ago as we set up auto enrollment, where what you do is you nudge people through inertia. What you do is you have to opt out of contributing to a defined contribution, but you've got to be PAYE in order to be in that opt out model. So there is no auto enrollment if you are self-employed. So how do you use those same kind of behavioural economic leverages to support those that operate in a self-employed model to kind of incentivise retirement savings? And to be honest, the answer is it's really, really bloody hard. So there are some pilots that have been undertaken by Nest. So Nest is the government-backed defined contribution scheme. And what they have looked at is, can you have these kind of sidecar saving models? So what you effectively do is you kind of have two jars whereby you save in one that is a kind of emergency fund. It's the rainy day fund. So you will contribute a small proportion on a monthly basis when you are able to and engaged, and that will reach a certain level and then overspill into a defined contribution. And in their pilots, they found that by having that kind of structure, you do start to see an increase in that that kind of incremental saving amount of emergency savings that over time could lead to an increase in DC contributions. But in the pilot time that you know, the kind of within the window within which that pilot was undertaken, it wasn't meaningful in terms of what you saw in it from a kind of pension contribution perspective. So we're still not, we haven't found an answer that auto enrollment provides that leverage, because it will nudge people into that kind of retirement savings position. So I think there's some really big blue sky thinking that needs to happen around this. If we can't use auto-enrollment, if that doesn't exist as a kind of regulatory tool, what are the other ways that we can incentivize savings amongst that cohort? And don't know the answer is the honest position, Bernard, but, you know, is there opportunities for us to potentially use dormant assets? Could we look at investing dormant assets into a bond fund, and it's the kind of the income that you get from that is used to seed pension pots at a really small amount to potentially incentivize. It's the kind of the regulations that may sit around that might be difficult to unpick, but at the moment we're not even considering how do you get that baseline that actually provides people with the incentive to think, I've got something there. It's worth me when I'm in a position to when I'm engaged and I am freelancing, it's worth me contributing that small amount. And I think that is it's a really thorny, complex area, but I think it's one that the freelance champion needs to really grasp.
I would just like to throw in on that as well, is that one of the things that makes it really complicated is your status as a freelancer. I work through a service company. I have my own limited company. So I now pay my pension from that. Before that, I just had a random pension that I took out with somebody, can't remember who. I reached a point when I couldn't carry on paying because I couldn't afford it. And I took such a long holiday, they went, you can't pay in anymore. So that pension pot died. But then there's also the people who have to go on short-term contracts and PAYE contracts short-term, who in theory are allowed to join the company pension schemes. I found out that for all the times that I've ever worked PAYE before I got to level when I could be Schedule D, I could have been paying into a pension. Nobody told me. Only found out recently that I've missed all those opportunities. I think a portable pension, that is your own pension, that when you go and work for a company, you say, here's my pension pot, this is what you pay into. Thank you very much.
And that example that you described of not being told about auto-enrolment is a classic, and that is really something we need to challenge because, you know, we've been doing some stuff around pensions with our members. We had a webinar last night, actually, to talk about this issue, and it is absolutely huge. And as someone said earlier, it's a ticking time bomb, so we really do need to find the solution for this. But yes, employers have also got responsibility. You know, they don't tell people of their rights because that saves them money, and that cannot be acceptable.
So I'd love to start bringing in audience questions at this stage, and I think online we've already had a load coming through. So for people in the audience, I'm going to come to you in a second, but I just want to give one audience question from online to start off, and I think there'll be roving mics coming on as well. And I think it really picks up on that point that as soon as you start to unpick what freelancer means, it becomes very messy and very tricky. So, Mark, I've got a question for you. So we know that the term freelancer lacks a legal definition in the UK, and the project-based nature of that work makes it very hard to track and measure. So how might we move towards obtaining data on freelance workforce, building on some of the incredible work that's been done by organisations that we've got here today? What are some of the steps that we should be thinking about in terms of building that evidence infrastructure?
So I think there's an element of threading the needle here. On the one hand, it's important to acknowledge that every bit of the creative industries looks quite different. And so a one-size-fits-all model that tries to do something really effective across the creative industries, you know, capturing patterns of self-employment from, for example, people who are freelance creatives working in advertising and marketing, through to musicians and actors and visual artists and everything in between. It's going to be very, very difficult to make that work. And so I think working with individual trade bodies, trade unions, other representative bodies is really valuable, such that the idiosyncratic patterns of work where the idiosyncrasies are really important is effectively captured. You know, the last thing we want to do is say, here's an one-size-fits-all model, and then people in, say, graphic design saying, actually, there's something quite particular about the way that we work, and it hasn't been captured. But on the other hand, you don't want to do things in such a way that every single person is measured differently, because when you do that, you don't get that same breadth of evidence coming through effectively. At the risk of making work for myself, I think the PEC might actually be quite well situated in trying to navigate some of these tensions, making sure that something is suitably broad to capture lots of different parts of the creative industries, but not so broad that it flattens out a lot of some of these changes. And working with organisations, I'll always shout out the Office for National Statistics, which always gets too much stick in settings like this, who do absolutely brilliant work in trying to harmonise data, making sure that we can build on the great work that they're already doing in order to try to understand some of the real specifics of different modes of self-employment.
So you've gone on the record and committed to that. Yeah. We'll come back in a few months.
Yeah, this is being recorded. I know this is going to be on YouTube.
No, brilliant. Thank you, Mark. Okay, so I'd love to turn to the room for questions. I think we had one just at the front, this gentleman here.
You touched upon it a little bit, and it is a thorny, complex, nuanced problem. There's no silver bullet, absolutely. It starts with policy and taxation and fairer, kind of equitable taxation. There's conversations at the kind of balancing employment and self-employment, but not considering the differences in rights and benefits, which is one thing. We talked about education, both helping people at early stage careers, but also signposting to resources and so on. And they're all critical things to be doing. My question for the panel is, with increasing numbers of people finding themselves in self-employment, not through choice, but through circumstance, perhaps post-redundancy, lower numbers of jobs, or their industry is, that is the dominant model, therefore they don't choose to be in this space. What responsibility do hirers, do clients, do employers have to the self-employed to put some of that support in place? Because the minute they're not an employee, there's almost a hands-off approach. Sometimes, oh, I are 35, we can't possibly support them or do anything. Lots of excuses, but increasing numbers of organizations leaning upon the self-employed to deliver their work. What level of responsibility do you feel that hirers, employers have to the self-employed to deliver on part of the solution?
That is a great question. Alex?
From my point of view, huge, because that their business model won't work without those employees, without those people coming and doing the work for them. They need those skills, they need those talents, they need to nurture those skills and talents, otherwise their business model won't work. They also need to look after the progression of that talent at all stages of the career, not just entry. I know there's a lot of effort put into access to the creative industries for diversity, ethnicity, socioeconomic, whatever it may be, but there's very little support for those who are in the middle of their career and want to move on, want to sustain that career. So I would say the responsibility is huge.
Can I just, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, absolutely, I agree that it's huge as well. And I suppose picking up where I left off in terms of action for freelancers, I think what has certainly happened over the years since the pandemic in film and TV, or particularly amongst the broadcasters, is a recognition that they rely heavily on the freelance workforce and that they've gone too far in terms of putting everything at arm's length. So, yes, of course, because they were pushed by people like us, but also lots of freelancer groups that operate in film and TV to try and improve the situation. They did agree to all sit in the room together with us and with freelancers, obviously, to talk about things like, yes, where can people find information? Hiring practice, which is a huge issue. Mental health, which is terrible in film and TV, as we know. Things like long hours and working conditions and skills and training. So those conversations have really only just started, and there was quite a lot of nervousness around it because of competition and things like that. But I think there is certainly, and I am going to say good things about the BBC in this respect, because they have been quite instrumental in getting that off the ground. And in fact, Tim Davey, I have to say, did take it very seriously when we raised the issues around freelancers with him. So I think where those conversations go, I don't know, but I think there is a certain amount of goodwill, and I think we can challenge, we can resolve or partly resolve some of those really fractious issues that impact on film and TV in particular.
So we had another question. This woman over here, and then we've got another one in the middle as well.
Hello. Thank you. So it's just brilliant to have all these voices together and hearing just such a range of what you're doing. I have a dance background. I've worked as a professional dancer for 10 years, but I'm now researching at Essex, actually, with the Future of Creative Work team. I'm looking at the relationship between dance, freelance dancers, injury and precarity. And I think something that you picked up on is 80% of dancers work as freelance because that is what it is. There is no choice. It is project-based. But what's happening, obviously, with dancers working, their body is their tool. And like some other professions, I'm sure, like in running and production. So you've got the intersection of the fact that you're relying on this body to deliver. In the same way you say you turn up, you're also relying on this, you know, yourself to keep going. But there's also a real culture of gratitude, of passion, which I'm really interested in. You know, no other sector relies on that. A job is a job, but because it's a vocation, this kind of passion really means that exploitation is happening, which has come up a lot in research. And I guess I'm just really interested in when a culture is just so strongly ingrained of, you know, if someone doesn't take the job, there'll be someone else that will, because people are so short of money and they're so short of work. And the culture just is so hard to change. I believe it can, but it requires real implementation of policy. You know, if, for example, I guess this is kind of a question maybe for you, Yasmin, but more generally is, what ways can we really simply embed, you know, maybe funding you? I can't apply for funding if I do a minimum wage. Sorry, rejected. You've got to ask for hire, for example. I know that sounds silly, but there's got to be some core thing, because actually it's very hard for a lot of dancers to even ask for more money. They won't. They need the work. They want to work. So I'm kind of really curious about how we can really make it culturally acceptable to want more, to expect more, to have more. Thank you. Does that kind of, yeah.
That's such a brilliant question. I mean, I don't have the full answer, but what I will say is that it needs a systems level approach, because what one thing I'm really cautious of is a them and us mentality between freelancers on one side and organisations, because it's not. It's an ecosystem and there's movement, and freelancers sometimes become employees and then they become freelancers again. So, and I think we've got to, when the champion comes on board, they really, it can't just be they're looking at self-employment law. They've got to look at policy change across the board and how it impacts freelancers. So one example is the increase in national insurance. That had a direct repercussion on hiring practice, because of course you can't afford to keep staff on payroll. You just can't. You've got increased running costs. So therefore, you can throw out these few little crumbs, and then it will go to the lowest bidder. And so the question is, what's the incentive then to you know, there isn't one because of competition law. So this is kind of brutal reality we're working in that it kind of perpetuates this thing of malpractice. And then what you were pointing to is that freelancers just don't call it out because they need the job. There's that reputational backlash fear. And that's why the rise of CISA, the Creative Industry Standards Authority, is so vital. We do have a raising a concern process. So if you do feel that there is some malpractice, you can, you know, get in touch. It's more difficult to do anonymously, though. So there is that kind of gap. I completely hear what you're saying. But the thing about you using your body as a tool is so interesting, and it just makes me think about the services you need, you know, to equip yourself. I'm thinking of insurance, like you must, professional indemnity, public liability. So I just wanted to give a shout out to those organisations who offer that. So particularly the Artists Information Company, and this is might be useful for everyone here. They provide insurance, legal, tax helpline, and skills training for their membership, which is mainly visual arts, but also freelancers. ArtQuest also provide good resources as well. So there are things out there, and then you were talking about bad accountancy practice or not getting good advice. There's a niche, you know, hands up who's got a really good accountant who's an artist. You know, I want to hear about them, because I feel that there's a gap. How can we create opportunities for micro businesses that can supply freelancers with the services they need, but also the work they need, because it could be staffed by freelance accountants. So there is this kind of opportunity. It's not all, you know, it's a glass half full in my eyes.
So I think we had another question just at the front. Person with the blue jacket on.
Hi. So I've heard I'm a bit concerned that there's a sort of freelance champion in the future that will fix everything, but we could be doing lots of things now. And I guess I hear 125 billion, we've got an amazing arts contribution to the world here, but it's also the Wild West. Are we thriving because it's the Wild West? Are we thriving because there's been so little HR? And I see so many of these events, and so we're going to have the freelance champion and lots of people doing lots of individual work. I guess my query to the panel is, do we need like a baseline sense of decency of how the arts works? Because it's thriving in part because people have worked for not enough money, because they aren't given sick leave, they aren't given leave when their parent dies. So like, we already have that in place for employees because we've had to. Why don't we already have it in place for freelancers? Why aren't we treating freelancers as we would want our child or our parent to be treated? And I know that has to be put in with policy, but there has to be a baseline, because we can put all the guidance in the world in, but if we don't have a baseline of decency of how we want the industry to go forward, people will still leave, I think.
I mean, the simple answer to that, to my mind, is it's capitalism. You know, companies, the market goes for the cheapest option and the greatest profit. You know, if you can stiff the workforce, then they will. But that's me being cynical, sorry.
No, no, and so to add to that, I think there are also some more traditional organising methods that are successful. So BECTU, but also Equity and other unions do have collective agreements in certain parts of the industry. So we've got those which tend to be around working conditions because of obviously freelancers. But we are also exploring discussions about having further collective agreements around pay for some roles, and hopefully that will continue and grow. And also just actually where we are strong, where we have a good level of membership, which we do in some branches in film and TV, then we can actually make sure that we, through our rate cards, that people do get paid fairly and all of those things. So I think a combination of campaigning, but also using traditional methods of organising are probably the best way forward.
So we've got a question at the front here.
Is this thing working? Yeah. Yep. I guess it's kind of half statement, half question. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's interesting with the Policy Evidence Centre report. I mean, sitting here as a black man, just listening to that and not hearing any kind of reference to issues around black and global majority people who probably disproportionately are more freelancers who are black and global majority in the creative industries than are in the general population, simply because we don't get permanent jobs or we don't get in places of funding for companies on that set of our own initiatives and so on and so forth. So there are systematic, continuing legacy issues around black and global majority people and racial diversity, for example. I'm also queer, so there's an intersectionality within the way that I've experienced the arts. I worked in TV, I've worked in film, I've worked as a visual artist, I've worked in theatre, and I work as a performer. So there's another thing around the multiplicity, the interdisciplinary of freelancers, not just in terms of what we do as people, but also in terms of how we kind of bring our skills and expertise and value to organisations, and that's the other thing. So so this also relates then to pay and to contracts and to, as you all know, BECTU and Directors UK will know this, and to a certain extent it happens with Equity as well. The ways in which we can get fired as well as hired, which are deeply, deeply unfair. So it's the sense of buyouts, the idea of you buy out somebody for a fee and you can fire them within a week or 2 weeks without any explanation. That's actually a contractual thing, which is deeply exploitative. And there's also this other side, which is freelancers, who are all experts in this room, I imagine, and all of us have experienced being that email that says, we'd like you to come and talk on a panel, and this is the honorarium. I just, as an aside, I get a lot of this. I like to just banish that word because it's a way of exploiting freelancers in terms of their expertise at different levels. And I think there has to be recognition within whatever this czar is or within whatever campaign we have that the expertise I'd like to sort of move away from this emerging, established talk around freelancers, where there's a lot of stuff around the language of freelancers and artists, which kind of adds to the notion that there is a ways in which we can be exploited. And I just want to know what you might respond to that. Thank you very much.
That's a great question.
Yeah, are you happy for me to start?
Yeah.
Cool, so there's two things that I'll say, one shorter point, one longer point. I'm completely on board with banning the word honorarium in favor of the word fee, which I think captures what's going on a little bit more directly. I'll come back to your first point, which is what I did and didn't talk about in the presentation. So as I mentioned in the report, we cover quite a lot of things. In my presentation, I was largely just talking about distinguishing freelancers from other people. But yeah, exactly as you would expect, we do see some differences between people from black and global majority backgrounds as compared with white people, where it's a little complicated, little fiddly, but we find that black and global majority people are more likely to leave these occupations compared with their white peers. And in addition to this, that we find the experiences of Black and global majority people that we spoke to have been quite different. So you're absolutely right to bring that up. The content of the report will not surprise you, but you might find that some of the material that we talk about is instructive in that way. But I also completely agree about like the language around freelancers often being unnecessarily complicated. And if we just said to people, we are offering to pay you this much for this many hours work, it would perhaps be more transparent that, you know, you can put that into a minimum wage calculator and realize, yeah, none of this quite adds up, particularly if I'm supposed to be getting holiday pay. So yeah, completely on board with the position of let's just clean up the language and then the comparisons become a bit more straightforward.
Like to
I mean, just to say, yes, our research shows exactly as you say that you know all of the challenges that people face. If there is a crisis in the industry, the chances are that it's people from a global majority who end up struggling more, even more in terms of work and people with disabilities. And yes, if you're from a less advantaged background, then you're more likely to find yourself out of work and therefore end up leaving the industry. And we constantly talk about wanting to have a more diverse industry and yet do very little to challenge that in reality.
So I think we've got time for one more question. So we've got a question at the back, just over there.
Thank you. It's a great debate. I just want to try and get to the source of a problem. Capitalism and buyer's market, I think, is the source of the problem. And if you then revert back to the ultimate source of the problem, and I'd call that academia, and the way that the creative industries are fed by academia is pretty irresponsible. And I'll give you two examples. I've been an external examiner in interior design for 20 years. There are about between 50 and 60 undergraduate interior design courses turning out 30 to 40 students a year. There is no work, okay? There is no work in retail, there's no work in straight interiors. The students are given a false promise and they're flooding the market. Now, my son has just finished, Alex has finished a filmmaking course, an MA filmmaking course. He has a BA in electronic music from Berlin, and he has spent 1 year applying for work, and on LinkedIn he's told that 500 other people are applying for that job, okay? He's totally demoralized, and he's one of many. So my point is that the czar that's going to represent the freelancers has to go back to a very interesting source of the problem, which is the academic world, which is offering the market and flooding the market and creating the buyer's market that reduces the opportunities for those students. They're given a false promise. You look at the league tables, they all lie about, the universities lie about the number of students that are in employment. They lie, that's for sure, I know they do. And somebody has to tackle this problem, and you have to look at the kind of broad sense of what creative academia is offering and see whether that has to be adjusted. And sad to say, and I love the academic, creative academic world, of course I do, but somebody has to look at it pragmatically and understand whether it's the source of the problem.
I think it's a kind of supply and demand challenge. And Amy, actually, I was going to just put you on the spot because I know that was something that was picked up actually in your report, I think, wasn't it, in some of the focus groups?
Well, I mean, it's a challenging one because I think that it's not as binary as that. There are opportunities within certain subsectors. And I think that, you know, It's not a case that we are just turning out talent with nowhere to go. I think that there's a whole host of issues that you sort of need to address within that. It's how you make sure that you prepare people for a kind of, not necessarily the kind of set trajectory that they might wish to go into in the first instance. It's the skills that you might build and then subsequently go into another role within that ecosystem. I think, you know, assessing what the kind of trajectory is from certain courses into the creative industries is absolutely something we should do. But I think looking at the kind of the broader piece, this is a sector that has opportunity within it. So I think I'm not sure I can fully recognise the sentiment that what we're doing is we're churning out talent that has nowhere to go, kind of across the piece.
Can I come in on this as a person who works at a university? I'm really torn on this. Young people should be allowed and should be encouraged and should be supported to do what they love. And if doing what they love doesn't have a job at the end of it that is the same, that has the same name as the degree that they studied, that's okay. Nobody is saying that it's a tragedy that there aren't thousands of jobs working in ancient languages, but we still encourage students to study ancient languages if that's the thing that they love. And I would make the same argument about creative programs. I really don't think we want to end up in a situation where the only people who are able to study creative programs are those people who've come from independent wealth. At the same time, universities shouldn't be pretending that all of their graduates get jobs in the thing that they want to do if they if that's not the case, and we all know that it isn't. But I think in conversations like this, we often focus on that second point, that there's a real mismatch between the demand and supply in the market, and that maybe there needs to be a market adjustment so there are fewer graduates studying things that are the name of a job where they don't get a job in that thing. And I don't think we give enough attention to the fact that young people should be allowed to study what they love, regardless of their background.
So I think we're getting towards the end of the session, and I'd really like to just bring us back to where we started, which is the fact that we've got a freelance champion to be appointed, I think by the end of the year. I'd love to just ask our panel for a very brief reflection, for you to share one kind of recommendation that you would have for that freelance champion when they're coming in. So that might be a kind of key issue that we've maybe discussed today that you think they should focus on. It might just be a bit of advice that you would give them in navigating government from your experience in doing this. But Yasmin, I'd love to maybe start with you if you could share any thoughts you might have.
Yeah. So I think fundamentally it's got to be about improving working conditions. We need consistent standards across the whole sector. So Arts Council isn't regulated, but what we can absolutely do is hold organisations that we fund to account. But we need more of a carrot and a stick. So CISA, the Creative Industries Standards Authorities, have developed quality hallmarks and a pathway for affordable arbitration. I think that's the missing link, is most freelancers can't afford a good lawyer. So, I mean, that, you know, is definitely something. But, I mean, I just want to underscore that this work is really nebulous. It has no hard edges. This is a huge remit. I think it's not just about the kind of tacit knowledge they have of the sector, but also the soft skills to bring the sector together and have that holistic approach. But if I can be cheeky, because we were talking about academia, I think it's important to acknowledge that all of our research builds on and complements on a large body of research that has happened, often at grassroots level. So we've got Creative United here in the audience with us today. DAX, the Design and Copyright Society, have produced Living Artist Report. Artists Union England, Creative UK, of course. Freelancers Make Theatre Work, latest big survey. ArtQuest and Susan Jones is an independent researcher into artists' lives, and they all play an important role in reinforcing those issues. So what I'd really love to do is work with a freelancer champion to build a data observatory and use all of these rich insights to make a greater case for public investment in individuals.
Thank you, Yasmin. Amy?
I suppose for me, what's the point of a champion? A champion is there to deliver impact. So over the first 12 months, we need to see some demonstrative impact. And I think the way that we get there then is that this isn't a statutory role. And I think we've all sort of, we've campaigned to kind of different degrees as to whether that should be the case. If we accept that it isn't statutory at the moment, we need to know that from 12 months from now, this freelance champion has come in, they've inquired, they've appraised, they've made recommendations, and whether there is a statutory duty to respond or not, we need to see from a policy-making perspective and for an industry that they are responding to those recommendations. And if we don't, then I think it's a different question as to, does that champion role have the necessary teeth in 12 months' time, or do we need to look at something that is a little bit more pointy?
Not so. Philippa, how about you?
Yeah, so I definitely agree with that point, that last point. I mean, the advice that I would give the incoming champion is to spend some time really talking to all of the people who've been campaigning and continue to campaign across the industry to improve things, because there is no one size fits all. And as we've heard today, there are lots of people doing really great work to try to make things better for freelancers. So that would be my advice. I think for our members, what they would want to see in what they would want to see in 12 months' time is a recognition that just because people work as freelancers, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't also enjoy some of the benefits that employees have. So the things that we talked about, to me, that question about how you support freelancers in the creative industries to continue to work in the creative industries and to not just survive but thrive is a really important one. And alongside that, the whole question of pensions as well, because it's got to be a whole life solution. So I'm not suggesting necessarily that's all going to be in place in 12 months, but I think a pretty clear idea of how, of what rights freelancers might expect in the future.
Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I would seek a clear definition of what it means to be a freelancer. I'd also look at the, on the off the back of that, the access. What that would mean is your status under tax, and therefore for Social Security. And with that, I look at say the Irish Basic Income for the Arts scheme or the French Social Security scheme. Just for that, when you are between jobs, that you do have an income, and that's something that really needs to be established in law as to what a freelancer is, and therefore you can define it, and therefore you can tick that box on the car insurance, you can tick that box on the mortgage application.
Thank you, and Mark.
We've talked about a lot of different challenges on this panel. For me, not all of it, but about 80% of it comes down to money. And I think where the Freelance Champion program has to start is an acknowledgement that there's a lot less money than there used to be. The distribution and concentration of that money looks very different from where it used to. And if we want to really support and develop freelancers, we need to start there.
I think that's a brilliant note to end on. Well, all that's left for me to say is a massive thank you to all of our speakers for sharing your time and thoughts so generously. Huge thank you as well to all of you in the audience, both in person and online, and for all of the really good questions as well. Please do follow the RSA and Creative Peck on our channels for future events and future reports. And if you've got time, do have a read of the State of the Nations report that Mark has shared as well. It's a really good read. But for those of you online, have a wonderful rest of the day. For those of you in person, if anyone would like to stay, there's some tea and coffee and a chance to just chat and hang out downstairs in the Benjamin Franklin room as well. So if you'd like to stay along, do make your way downstairs. And that's it. Huge thanks again. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.